Well, good morning and Happy New Year. 2020, eh? My name's Matt, I'm one of the church staff. And a particular welcome, as Beck said earlier, if you're a guest. Maybe you're here because you were at one of the carol services and you thought, well, that was brilliant. So you came back and now you're here and it's January and there's no decorations and there's no choir and you're concerned that I might talk for ages. Welcome to you as well. Hope you have a great morning. And this week, we're starting a little series. We look at something in the Bible every week. We're starting a little series looking at some big questions people have about God and about faith. And there's loads of them. But we're starting this week with probably the main thing. What's the point of Christianity? What's the point of Christianity? Is it about funny clothes, as it is in some sort of denominations, it would seem? Is it about rules? Is it about wishful thinking about a God that you wish was there? Is it about doing lots of singing? Is it about something else? But as well as that, I start my new role this week as leader of this church. And I also want to begin with a bit of the Bible. This is my favorite bit of the Bible, this. And I want to do this because it's absolute core business for us. For me, this view of God underpins all the great stuff we do. It gets to the heart of what God's like. And so it should be at the heart of what we're like as a church. For those of us who've been Christians for ages, you'll know this story. You will. But the message in it, I think, is the best way for us to start the 2020s. This is brilliant. For me, this passage we're going to look at, it's the center of the Christian message. It's the best way I've seen it explained. It's in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15, if you'd like to know these things. And it may surprise you to learn, before we get into it, that this is Jesus speaking to a group of very religious people, very self-righteous religious leaders, and he's questioning how they see God. So that's the context. He's questioning how they see God. He's saying to the most religious guys on the planet, you've missed it. You've got it wrong. It's something else. And so he tells this incredible story, and it's not long, but it catches something about what people are like and what God is like in just this amazing way. So let's have a look. It'll be on the screen, and I'm going to read it as well. Jesus tells this story. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Jesus begins the story with a fantastic hook that gets everyone's attention. He's a great storyteller. This man has two sons. And what would normally happen in that culture is when he died, the older son of the two would get 2/3 of the estate, and the younger son would get 1/3, which doesn't seem very fair to us. That's what happened. As an older son, I think this is completely fair. But the younger son comes to his dad while he's still alive and says, I want my share now. I want my share now. And basically, you know, this might make some economic sense, inheritance tax and everything, but basically this is the most offensive thing he could say to his dad in that culture. It's like he's saying to your dad, the man that raised you, I want my life to be like it would be if you didn't exist. I want my life to be like it would be if you were dead. I want you to be dead to me so I can spend your money, please. Why does he say this? Somehow he's got to this place in his life where he knows he enjoys his dad's stuff, his money, his possessions, more than he likes his dad. At least he's honest about it. And the crowd listening would have been immediately hooked because this is shocking. They're standing there shaking their heads. What Jesus does, this is very clever, is he makes the crowd against this younger son from the beginning. They're all shaking their heads. Remember, this is the so-called good people who are listening, the religious rules people. So their instinctive reaction is to think, oh God, honestly, that younger son, people like him, they're the problem in this world, those selfish people that are not like us, those selfish people. But also imagine the dad in the story too. What emotions is he going through? Anger, disappointment, sadness, rejection. But right from the beginning, this dad doesn't react in the way that he has a right to. He could tell his son where to go, and nobody would bat an eyelid. He could use some very choice language. But what he does is he gives the son what he asks for. The word used here for property, originally it was a Greek word, bios, which means life. Literally it's saying the father divided his life between his two sons. And it continues. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I'll set out and go back to my father's house and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So the son takes his share and he heads off. He ends up in a distant country. He puts physical distance between himself and his dad. He ends up in wild living. Think wine and women and fast cars, and it's all a lot of fun until the day that it isn't. The inheritance runs out. The distant country away from dad, it seemed so appealing, didn't it? I can do what I like. I can make my own decisions. I can make my own rules. Nobody will tell me what to do. I'll define everything about my life. It promised so much, but it delivered so little. Eventually, the parties were over. The people who were his friends at the parties have disappeared, surprisingly. And the son ends up feeding pigs. For a Jewish man, this is like the lowest of the low. The worst job you can imagine. He's so desperate, he's thinking, I'd love some pig food about now. Delicious. But now that he's a man without money, nobody cares about him enough even to give him that. And then it finally happens. He came to his senses. There's a lot of emotion in this story. But this is a moment of rationality. This is logical. Now notice, he doesn't begin with genuine regret about his dad. He begins with desperation. My dad's servants have got loads of food. If I go and say sorry to him, I could probably get work as one of those servants. It's got to be better than the pig thing. Now, this son's made a number of mistakes, but the thing behind them all, and this is very important, is how he views his dad, how he sees his dad. He has no idea how much his dad loves him. He's so focused on his dad's stuff, his possessions and his money, he has no idea. And he thinks, if I go home, maybe I can rejoin the family at the bottom rung of the ladder. That's the maximum he thinks might be possible. Maybe I can be a servant. He's got no idea. Have you ever been in one of those situations where you've done something so bad that you have to rehearse an apology before you make it? Like you run through all the words, what are you going to say? And he does that. The apology's pretty good. It's got all the right things in it. He says, "I'm not worthy to be your son. I've sinned against heaven and against you." Great words. But we know, you know, a lot of the motivation here is that he's hungry. He's in need. He's sorry because his life isn't very good. And you know what? I think the dad knows this. You can tell when an apology is heartfelt and when it's done for another reason. I think when the son comes home, his dad knows what's going on, and we'll see his response. It's not based on his apology, but he has got an apology in the bag. Story continues. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." This is absolutely wonderful. While he was still a long way off, his dad saw him. The only way that could have happened is that his dad was looking out for him. He was looking out for him. Maybe he was sat in his chair on the front porch, waiting, hoping, praying that his son would come home. And the moment he sees him, he runs. He sprints. Now, in that culture, dads didn't run. It was seen as undignified. It was embarrassing. The whole community would have been looking away. This dad doesn't care. He doesn't care what people think. The fact that he goes to his son before his son can even squeeze out that apology tells us two things. Firstly, as I said, his love for his son is not based on how good the apology is. He doesn't care. He loves him regardless. He just wants him to come home. It's not about the words. And secondly, this is really important. He's already forgiven him before he gets home. He's already forgiven him before he gets home. Now, if you've ever had to forgive for anybody, and I'm sure you have, you'll know it costs something when you forgive somebody. The worse the offence, the bigger the cost. Not money, of course, but emotionally, it costs something to forgive, to let the other person go. This father has already done the hard work before his son comes home. The huge emotional cost of forgiveness has been done in the father's own soul. And that's why when he sees his son, he throws his arms around him and kisses him. Before the son can say anything, before the village pounce on him and beat him up, which would have happened, his dad publicly communicates, no, he's restored. He's my son and he's restored. And it's only after that the son squeezes out his rehearsed apology. And all his words are true. He's not worthy of his dad. Maybe by now there's some genuine remorse. He's already been accepted. But his dad isn't really interested. He moves the conversation on. The father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. This dad is so excited to have his son home. It's the best day of his life. But if you step back from this, there's a few ways the father could have dealt with this. A few ways that he could have gone about this. Firstly, he could have been completely fair. The son could have come home and he could have said, "Well, son, you know, I do love you and stuff, but it was your choice. You've made your bed. You've got to lie in it. You've taken the inheritance. You've embarrassed us all. That was your choice. You're a grown man. You're not my son anymore." And that would have been fair. And everybody in the village would have agreed that's fair. Or he could have been merciful. He could have said, "Well, you've been really, you know, you've been a really bad boy. You've been terrible, shocking. But because I love you, I'm going to give you a chance. Tell you what, why don't you, you've got that good idea. You could be one of my hired men. You could work for me for a few years. If you play your cards right, maybe eventually I'll bring you back into the family. But you've got to earn it. You've got to try harder. It really was very offensive what you did. I was very upset by that." Now, if the father had done that, that would have been merciful, wouldn't it? Nobody would have said that was harsh. Everybody would have said that's a very nice thing to do. But the third thing goes even further. He could be gracious. He could do this based on grace. Now, as Christians, we like the word grace, but it's often misunderstood. What it means is extravagant, over the top, unwarranted, unearned favor, excessive, ridiculous, silly love and favor towards someone who not only hasn't earned it, but actively doesn't deserve it. It's a bit like if someone owed you loads and loads of money and you didn't just write off the debt, you also gave them a load of money on top. It would just be silly, ridiculous. And that's what this father's like. He has this massive party. They kill the fattened calf. That's the best meat that they've got. It's reserved for a special occasion. And that's why it's not just justice or fairness. It's not even just mercy. It's grace. It's totally the extra mile. What the father does costs more than the best meat. It's the price of forgiveness. It's taken the emotional pain onto himself, his own reputation. When he brings the younger son back, he makes him an heir again. The family is now a third worse off financially. But the younger son is restored to a position where he can now claim again a third of the inheritance. This is bonkers. And it affects everybody. The father is going to have to take the heat from the whole family. People who are not as gracious as he is. People who don't get it. And this is where the story changes gear. You see, this could be a lovely story, it'd make a great film, about a son who runs away and then he sort of gets things together and he comes back to his really lovely dad and they have a nice cuddle and then it's the end. And if this was a film, it would end with a tearful reunion. But again, this is Jesus being the master storyteller because there's another important character. Let's read. "Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother's come home,' he replied, 'and your father's killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.'" Oh dear. The older son was in the field. In other words, he was working. He's focused on the family business. He hasn't asked for his share of the inheritance early. He hasn't been the wild child. He hasn't wasted money. He's a good boy. Shouldn't we all be like him? Well, sometimes you get the impression that the older son represents what Christians are supposed to be like. Prudent, dutiful, moralistic, serious. But that's absolutely not the case, and that's part of Jesus' point. This older son is outside. He hears the music and the dancing and the eating, and you get the impression he's not the sort of person who's into any of this sort of thing. He's not into fun. And when he finds out what's happened, he's furious. He's furious because his dad has forgiven his brother. Someone else's forgiveness fills him with rage. He doesn't want grace. He doesn't even want mercy. He wants fairness. Fairness. And you can sort of understand his point of view. He's been a good boy. His brother hasn't. The little brat should live with the consequences, shouldn't he? On the surface, this older son is very well behaved. But underneath, he's very dark. How he responds tells us how he really sees everything. He thinks that love should be given on the basis of behaviour. For him, it's all very simple. He's been good. His brother hasn't. He's earned his dad's love and approval. His brother hasn't. You can relate to this, I'm sure, because by and large, this is how the world works. I imagine when we get to this bit of the story, the older brother is stood outside of the family house with his arms folded and his back to the house. And then his dad comes out and pleads with him. I said before, dads in that culture didn't run, but even more, they didn't come and plead with their oldest child. They tell them. They don't plead with them. This is an enormous concession. They're very different people, but this dad loves both of his sons. He bends over backwards for them. So the dad pleads, but look at how the older son replies. He gives himself away repeatedly here. He says, "All these years, I've been slaving for you." And that word says everything. He hasn't been working for his dad in appreciation for all the love and all the great things he gets for him and for the family business. In his mind, he's been slaving. In other words, the way he sees it, he isn't sufficiently rewarded for all the great work that he does and all the great things that he brings. He's slaving. His dad owes him more than he's getting. "I deserve a great life. I'm not given what I deserve for all my goodness." Can you see the arrogance? Can you see that despite the fact that outwardly he does the right things, he obeying the rules, being sensible, the older son is absolutely filled with pride and superiority. So he looks at his little brother and he thinks, "I'd never be as bad as that. I'm a good person." Look at even how he speaks of his brother to his dad. He says, "This son of yours, not my brother, this son of yours." If he'd known his own heart, he would have realized, "I am just as self-centered as my little brother. I'm just the same. I have no right to feel superior." But older brother types don't see themselves in this way. And just like his brother, here's the great irony. Just like his brother, he wants the same things. He actually wants the same things. He wants the dad's stuff. He doesn't want him around. Look at that little glimpse of what he wants. He says, "You never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends." Bearing in mind that this older brother hasn't left and come back, what is it he wants to celebrate? What does he want to celebrate? Very simply, he wants to celebrate himself. Just his own greatness. That's what he wants to celebrate. And he doesn't want his dad there. He wants to celebrate with his friends. So he's actually quite similar to his brother. Think about it. Both of them want their dad's stuff. Neither of them really want their dad. They just have different ways of getting there. The younger son takes what he can and runs. The older son plays the long game and thinks, "If I slave away, my dad will owe me all sorts of nice things. I'll earn them." Neither son has a clue how much their dad loves them or what an enormous privilege that love is. They don't have a clue. And the story ends with the father's words. "My son," the father said, "you're always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Look at how the dad speaks. "My son, you're always with me and everything I have is yours." In spite of his attitude, just like with his brother, this dad is willing to give him everything he has. And the story ends with this wonderful dad giving this bitter, selfish older brother this little challenge. I know you don't want me to forgive your brother, but I already have. And I'm celebrating unashamedly because he's home. You could join us. You could come in the house with us. And Jesus, this is why it's genius, he ends the story here. Your brother's home. What are you going to do? He leaves the audience hanging. The younger son, he went off and then he came back home, and that's resolved. But at the end of the story, the older son is still outside the house, arms folded. Is he going to come back inside? And Jesus does this very deliberately. Remember, the audience was a group of very religious people, classic older brother types. They follow the rules. They're good people, they think. They look down on people who are not like them. And Jesus is pushing them to finish the story. He's saying, okay, you guys are like the older brother. How will you respond? What are you going to do? Will they come back into the house, so to speak? Will they stay out in the field, sulking in bitterness, a father who extends forgiveness to people who don't keep the rules? So that's the story. But at the beginning, I said this story communicates the Christian message like nothing else. And I wonder if you picked up how as we went through. Helpful way to do this might be to think about the characters again. Firstly, there was the younger son. He doesn't want to be restricted. He doesn't want rules. So he goes off to discover himself, do his own thing. He has a gap year in the Far East, maybe. He tries to find himself. And his mindset is different people, new places, new experiences. That's what I need. I need to just go and experience stuff and get in all the nice things I can for myself. But it can't last forever. Never does. And a younger brother sort of personality might think like this. Nobody has the right to tell me anything. I define myself. My identity is what I say it is. I get to decide. I'll find happiness by experiencing everything that I want. I'll just go out there and get it. Oops, sorry. I'll read the last one. The big problem in the world is older brother types. Not people like me. The big problem in the world is older brother types. That's the way he'll be thinking. But behind all this, what's this person trying to do? When you look at his life, this younger brother is trying to find something transcendent, something that brings his life the joy and the contentment that he struggles to find. And the way spiritually this plays out in our society is that you stay as irreligious as possible. The church tends to, from outside, look like a gang of older brothers, rules and conformity. So you stay as far away as possible. It's completely understandable. You just follow your own path. I don't want to be restricted. And yet I'm willing to bet that if that's you, then under the surface, you know this isn't producing the results you're after. Eventually, the younger son in the story faces a crisis. If you're looking for contentment in sleeping around, getting drunk, having amazing holidays, getting the house of your dreams, etc., 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 all the different things we come up with, those are just big ones. Whatever, I think you know, whether you want to engage with it or not, that it's not enough. It doesn't work. And those aren't all necessarily bad things, but you might be afraid that if you could just try everything, it might not be enough to satisfy. It might even be that you've done life for long enough that you're very aware that it doesn't work. The younger son went to a distant land because it promised everything, but it didn't deliver. It never does in the end. Secondly, there was the older son. He's responsible. He pays his taxes. He budgets sensibly. He appreciates discipline and hard work. Outwardly good things. But his mindset is, if I do good things, if I behave the right way, I'll get all the stuff I'm entitled to. I'll be owed it. And the sort of things an older brother might think, but never admit, are things like this. The world would be better if everybody was more like me. Anybody ever thought that? Anybody ever not thought that? I live so well that I deserve for good things to happen to me. I should have good things. People should see and acknowledge all of the good that I bring. I should be being told all the time. I'm glad I'm better than that person over there. I'm not pointing at you, Bruce. The big problem in society is younger brother types. That's what older brothers always think. What's this person looking for? He's waiting for the day when he will be celebrated. What he wants is recognition. He wants people to acknowledge he's a good person. He's done well. His way is best. But why does he want that? Because there's something in us that desperately wants to be valuable. We want to be worthwhile. When it comes down to it, we want somebody, we don't even know who necessarily, to say, you're worth it, you've done well, you have value. We want to hear that. And so older brother types are often religious. And I don't just mean in terms of like Islam, Judaism, etc., etc., but in the sense that older brothers are constantly playing an internal game of trying to justify themselves to God. Even if they say they don't believe in God, they're never happy because they know that deep down they fall short. And for older brother types, life is a constant comparison contest, even over small things. Older brothers have to have the bigger bank balance, or win the board game, or show that they've done more chores than their spouse, or have better behaved kids, or be seen to pray more than everyone else, or have a better moral track record, etc., etc. And every time they fail, they will immediately jump into a list of excuses for why they failed that means it's not their fault. Because if it's their fault, that means maybe they aren't good enough. And every person around them is a potential rival, even those that they love, because it's somebody who might do something better than them and therefore be more worthy somehow. And that's why older brotherism always leaves you lonely. And similarly, it doesn't work. Again, even if I have never spoken to you personally, I am willing to bet you have experienced this. Because while probably all of us is probably more like one of these brothers, I think we're all like both of them at different times. These are just classically human things that we do. But the most important character in the story, of course, is the father, the dad. Now you can probably tell the dad in the story is supposed to represent what God is like with us. And this is really important because you might be somebody that thinks that God is like the older brother in the story. That's the impression of God that people often get for some reason. And if God was like that, you'd be right to steer clear. But Jesus doesn't describe him that way. This dad is the sort of dad you would love to get to know. Look at what he communicates in the story when he interacts with his sons. I'll give you everything I have. I'm waiting for you to come home, and I'll run or I'll plead. I don't care what you've done. Because I love you. I'll do whatever I can, whatever it takes to be close to you. So I said at the beginning, I was going to tell you what the central Christian thing was. And this story, I think, captures it. We all reject this father in our own ways. We pursue experiences and we seek joy in things that are limited and dissatisfying. And we justify ourselves by how good we are or how successful we are in 1,000 different ways. And it doesn't work. And yet this dad God, loves us and will do anything to get us. That's what this story is about. It's what Christianity is about. It's the best news in the world. But how on earth could this happen? I mentioned earlier that for this father to embrace his sons after how they treat him would have taken a lot of work internally. We all know forgiving someone's very hard. For God to embrace us means he has to deal with the huge pain about how we reject him. But he does. Jesus told this story to a bunch of older brother types who were concerned that he liked old younger brother types too much. They were the people that ended up killing him. But what nobody knew was that this was God as a father dealing with all the things the dad in the story had to deal with, betrayal and hurt and anger, by placing it on Jesus, the storyteller. Jesus is God himself on earth. It's incredible. He takes it all on. He dies and rises again so that God says to each and every one of us, I'll give you all I have. I'm waiting for you to come home. I don't care how good or bad you've been. I've done everything necessary to be close to you. So will you come back? And that means all that remains for us is to consider, will we run home? Will we come home, even with mixed motives like the younger son? Or are we going to stand outside in a huff, thinking we know best and thinking that we deserve loads of good things like the older son? The dad is waiting with open arms. If you're visiting this morning, I'm sure this doesn't clear up every question you might have about the whole Christianity thing. But all I can say is, please come back and explore it further. This is the heart of it. Everything else is secondary. And we'd love as a church to be a place where you can check this out without pressure. We've got all sorts of ways to do that, but please do come back. If you would call yourself a Christian, I think this passage is one of the best things around for clearing your head, for resetting. This is a good week in the calendar to reset around what is core business for our faith. And it might be for you, you've lost your way a bit. You've forgotten what God's like, and you've sort of wandered into the younger brother way of thinking. You're just sort of keeping God at arm's length, and that's all, you know, you're going to do that. Or it might be, on the other hand, you've forgotten what God's like, and you've made it about how hard you try, and you're pedaling really hard, and you're trying to be good, and you're trying to do the right things, and you're starting to get into an entitlement mentality, and you're starting to criticize other people, and you're just getting tired. Either way, your dad is waiting with open arms. Your dad is waiting with open arms. That is the point of this story. Let me pray. Father God, thank you that you are just that. You're a father. You're a good father like the one in this story. And we are like the sons in this story. We've got all our own ways of defining ourselves, looking for our own path, doing our own thing. And at the center of it, it's often because we want your stuff. We want all the great things about this world, and we don't want you. And I pray for anyone in this room who's never heard this before, that you would just make the penny drop, please, Lord. That you're not a God who's like the older brother in the story, who's just harsh and into rules and looking to condemn, but you're full of grace like the dad. Please let us take hold of that. Even those of us who've been Christians for a while, we know this, but let us take hold of it afresh today. It's not about us, it's about what you've done for us, that you love us and you welcome us with open arms. Amen.